Thomas Curran är forskare i socialpsykologi vid London School of Economics. Han har skrivit boken The Perfection Trap som nyligen kommit ut på svenska via Mondial förlag med titeln Perfektionsfällan. I det här avsnittet svarar Thomas Curran på frågor som vad som utmärker en perfektionist, på vilket sätt perfektionism leder till psykisk ohälsa, om perfektionism är ärftligt och om det verkligen blir bättre när vi försöker göra saker perfekt. Och hur kan vi läka våra perfektionistiska drag så att vi kan må bättre? Det här avsnittet är på engelska. Welcome to Medberoende podden, or the Codependency podcast, Thomas Curran.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our chat.
Thank you. How are you feeling today?
Feeling very good. Yeah, it's been a long week, but I am enjoying Stockholm. It's nice to explore the city and it's been a nice break. I have a very small infant at home who isn't giving me much sleep, so I am feeling quite refreshed. Obviously, looking forward to seeing them again, but at this moment in time, I'm just enjoying being rested and talking to people about perfectionism.
So, about perfectionism, you're here because we're going to talk about your book that is in Swedish called Perfektionsfällan. It's the perfection trap, right? Mm-hmm. So my first question is, how did you come to develop this interest in the subject perfectionism?
I just think it was something that was so common. Like, I saw it everywhere, but most notably I saw it myself. I felt extreme pressure to be perfect when I was in my 20s, put a lot of pressure on myself, particularly in the workplace. Academia is a really competitive world, and it's tough. You gotta do the evenings, you gotta do the weekends, you gotta put yourself, push yourself, and so I think it was really that experience, and then the experience of other people around me, my students, my friends, and everybody seemed to be pushing themselves really, really hard, and perfectionism seemed to be something that was driving a lot of those behaviors. So I thought, this has got to be something we got to look at, you know, we really need to know more about this. So I did the research and here I am today.
So let's start with a question. What is perfectionism? How would you describe it?
So perfectionism at root is a form of deficit thinking. So it's this idea that I'm not good enough, I'm not perfect enough, and that in order to feel recognized, accepted, or loved, I suppose, if you really want to get at the root of it, I need to be perfect. I need to show the world that I'm bulletproof, that there's no chinks or flaws in the armory. And I think that's really such an important place to start with perfectionism, because we can often confuse it, can't we, with things like high standards, conscientious meticulousness. But actually, perfectionism really comes from a place of less than or lack. And if we can start there, then we can begin to understand why it is that perfectionism might not be such a positive trait that perhaps we think it is.
If you would look at, like, perfectionism in the other way, so what could be good with perfectionism? What can you gain from it?
I think the question is really not so much, can we use perfectionism to do great things? I don't think there's any doubt that there's many, many high-profile people who say that perfectionism has helped them move forward. But really, a better question is, can we do things differently and still get the same outcomes? And I think that's where we can begin to unpack what the difficulties are of perfection. Because yes, you know, we do have these exceptionally high standards, but it also comes with some really difficult baggage. Things like shame and guilt and feelings of not being worth or low self-esteem. It's those feelings combined with high standards which creates perfectionism, which is what perfectionism is. And I think we can have those high standards without that baggage. So I think the question is not necessarily so much, you know, can we use perfectionism as a positive, but actually, are there other ways to strive? things like conscientiousness, being meticulous, being diligent, you know, come from a very active and optimistic place of wanting to do better.
Yeah.
That can give us just the same outcomes, but for far less of that emotional difficulty.
Yeah, but I guess that a person who is a perfectionist don't really see it the way that it's something bad, maybe until you start getting maybe negative consequences and you start seeing it. But I would guess that most people who really focus on being perfect sees it probably as something, you know, good in them. Or what's your experience?
Yeah, that was me.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Like I didn't want to let go of my perfectionism. I held on for it for dear life. Because perfectionism was what I believed was holding me up, was making me successful. What if, when, especially when things in my life, other areas of my life, things were going not so well, I felt that it was the one thing keeping me on the right path. And that's common for many perfectionistic people. You know, they really hold it close. But I think what's important is we recognize that what we think is helping us is actually the thing that's holding us back. And that actually, you know, those feelings of inadequacy, those worries, those doubts, the mental health difficulties that we push ourselves through, all of them at root are really coming from that deep sense of need to be more, to do more, to have more, to not feel that we're enough in this moment. And so it's really important to recognize that this isn't something that we should cherish, that we should lionize. This is actually something that is creates a lot of difficulty. And if we can realize that, then we can go about driving in different ways that don't give us that baggage but make us far happier.
So who would you describe, who is a perfectionist? I mean, what kind of attributes or personality traits, or what can we see in someone who is a perfectionist?
Well, there's a couple of things to look out for. One is that you feel never satisfied. When you've been successful, there's a sense in the perfectionistic person that it's fine, it's good, but that was the level I should have achieved anyway because I have high standards, so it doesn't give you permission to enjoy it. But at the same time, it always has us thinking about what's next. You know, the better we do, the better we feel like we're expected to do. So there's no kind of joy, contentment or satisfaction in perfectionistic people. There's always a looking ahead at what's next. And on top of that, what we can also see in perfectionistic people a lot is when things happen that create a lot of difficulty in our lives, like challenge, setbacks, failures and all the rest of it, there's an intense self-criticism, you know, a self-loathing about those very human fallibilities. So we go in on ourselves, how could we be so stupid, what were you thinking, all these kind of thought processes come in. And so we find it really difficult mentally with challenge, and we also can't appreciate or have some satisfaction in success. And these are the two kind of the things that go on a lot in perfectionistic people's head, and of course that doesn't allow us any space, you know, to enjoy and savor. So those are the telltale signs.
And you also write in the book about this scale that you can measure how much of a perfectionist you are, and it's called the MPS, the multidimensional perfectionist scale.
That's right.
Yes. And this focuses on three directions or types. Would you like to describe them?
That's right. Yeah, there's three types of perfection. So we spoke for decades to perfectionist people. We've tried to understand what makes them tick, why, what their behaviors look like, what the thought processes and emotions feel like. And what we find time and time again is that perfectionism is not just about high self-set standards. So I need to be perfect enough, but perfect is something called self-oriented perfectionism. But also, there's a social element to perfectionism too, right? So we feel like the world expects us to be perfect just as much as we expect ourselves to be perfect. And that's called socially prescribed perfectionism, the perception that other people and everyone around me expects me to be perfect. But there's also a third type, which is perfectionism that's turned outwards onto other people. So I expect you to be perfect, I'm nothing but perfect, and I'm going to let you know if you've made a mistake or whatever. So these is the three main components of perfectionism. This is what perfectionism looks like. It's not just high self-set goals, but it's social perceptions and the projection of perfection onto other people.
Does someone who has this or would count like perfectionist, do they have to like get high scores in all three of these, or high on one of these three types?
Yeah, and that's what we see all the time. Different people have different constellations of those traits, right? So some people can be high on self and low on social. Some people can be really high on social, low on self, and all sorts of different combinations in between. That's the great thing about perfection. No one size fits all, or most interesting thing. Everybody has their own kind of character and profile. And I would also urge us to think about perfectionism in terms of a spectrum. So, you know, we're not really a perfectionist or not a perfectionist, but actually we are perfectionistic, and we're either very highly perfectionistic or not very highly perfectionistic or somewhere in between. And so it's very important to think about perfectionism in those terms, because it tells us that, you know, just because one perfectionistic person demonstrates a certain trait, that doesn't mean to say that somebody else who demonstrates different traits doesn't have just as much perfectionism. The difference, it really is how it's expressed, where it comes from, and how it's being channeled.
Yeah. My next question would be, if a perfectionist always gets it perfectly done, but you talked about what drives a perfectionist is somewhat of an illusion. What is your experience?
Well, a perfectionist never gets it done, because there is no perfect outcome. And as soon as something's been accomplished or achieved, we're moving on to the next thing. There's no permission within perfectionism to stop, to say that's good enough, to be happy with what we've created and put it out into the world content that we did our best. That just doesn't happen with perfectionistic people. They will always feel like there was something that they could have done better, that there's something they could have done more, and the next time I have to make sure that I do that or I do this. And so perfectionism, you know, when we're talking about performance and we're talking about outcome, perfectionism can really hold us back more than it carries us forward, because of the blocking effect of the perfectionism on our ability to just finish and let go.
So you mentioned the downsides of perfectionism. What are these? What kind of issues or negative consequences does perfectionism end up with?
Yes, left unchecked, perfectionism can lead to a lot of mental health difficulties, things like anxiety, low mood, depression. These are things it's correlated with self-presentational concerns, ruminative thoughts and cognitions. A lot of very negative mental health outcomes, essentially. And that's because perfectionists are just so vulnerable to stress, setbacks. They're very self-critical when they encounter difficulties. They have very low self-esteem, which means we're dependent on other people's approval. And so when we don't receive that approval, we can feel very bad about ourselves. And in order to compensate for those very negative feelings, we tend to set even higher goals for ourselves. So you can begin to see how you get into a very negative cycle with perfectionism that creates the difficulties and setbacks that are so challenging for us at mental health. When it comes to performance, the story is a little more interesting, because what we don't see is the performance benefits that that actually you might think you would see from perfectionism. So we kind of know, don't we, that perfectionism has all these negative outcomes. We sort of know that, but we also think that it's something that's going to help us achieve. But we don't see that in the data. We do see the difficulty and struggle in the data, but we don't see the achievement. And that's really curious. In fact, that's one of the most curious findings in the perfection of literature, that not only do you not get the success, you get the negative mental health outcomes, but you don't get the success either. So that's some of the correlates and the interesting findings in perfection literature.
And you're right about the study, a correlation study in English. How would you describe it? The study, like what did you do, and what kind of results ended up?
Yeah, so you measure these things that we talked about earlier, the self-oriented, socially prescribed. You ask people questions about how, you know, do you strive to be perfect? Do you feel that others expect perfection of you? Do you project perfection onto other people? You know, we ask them about these self-descriptive statements about themselves, and people either agree or disagree, right? And so, as I say, we just look at perfectionism spectrum. Some people score high, some people score low, some people score in the middle. And what we can also do on top of those measures is measure other things. Now, how much anxiety do you feel in general? How much where would you say you sit on the spectrum of depression? Is your mood high or low? Do you worry about things a lot? How do you think you appear relative to other people? So there's all sorts of other things that we can measure at the same time as perfectionism. And what you tend to see in the data when we've done that exercise is that those who score higher on perfectionism tend to score higher on the things that we mentioned, anxiety, depression, etc. Now, these are just correlations. They're circumstantial. One thing seems to be associated with another. Doesn't mean it's causal, but what we can tell through decades and decades of doing a lot of this work is that the correlations that are coming back tend to come back in the same direction at the same magnitude, which suggests to us that there's probably a very strong link here. And although we can't definitively say it's causal, we can say with a great deal of certainty that there is something going on here.
And I mean, what is it, would you say, in perfectionism that makes us feel? I mean, you said you couldn't really put a point on that it was actually causing it, but with your experience, what is it with perfectionism that actually makes us feel that bad?
Couple of things. First thing is that perfectionistic people worry a lot about how they appear, and they are intently defensive in their personalities, so they don't want to show any weakness. What that means is that they move away from people a lot. Because if they put themselves into social situations where they might be judged, perhaps critically, the anticipated shame is so fierce that they remove themselves from situations. And that creates a lot of what we call social disconnection, loneliness. And loneliness has a major impact on our mental health. But there's a second reason too why perfectionistic people struggle with mental health and why we see these correlations. And that's because perfectionists are very stress reactive. They're very vulnerable to situations that are out of their control. So when you have heartbreak, grief, when you fail, for instance, the emotions that are stirred up in those moments are really intense. You feel a lot of guilt, feel a lot of embarrassment, feel a lot of shame. Shame is massive with perfectionistic people. And so what that means is you become very sensitive to stressful events. And so the more stressful events that occur in your life, the more they get amplified by your perfectionism, the more they get blown out of all proportion, and the more they take over your entire life. And if you don't get on top of that early, that can really cascade into some significant mental health difficulties, because that repressed anxiety, that repressed mood, has got nowhere to go apart from outwards when it gets too much. So it's stress vulnerability, and it's also social disconnection. These are the two main reasons why perfectionists struggle.
I really like this. You write in the book, I'm going to read it in Swedish first. There's a quote. Livet blir en ändlös rättegång mot våra brister. And this is me translating it back to English because I've written the Swedish version. So life becomes an endless trial against our flaws. I don't know if you would put it exactly that way, but I thought that was a really like on point quote. How would you describe this? What is it that you're...
Yeah, we just feel like we're constantly in the dock, having to defend our flaws and shortcomings so that other people accept us, because we live in a world that demands perfection all the time. It demands us to show our very best selves all the time. There's no room in that world for vulnerability, certainly if we want to get ahead. And so that's sometimes how it feels to be a perfectionistic person. You just feel like you're always on trial, you're always being watched, you're always being judged, and so naturally you're going to try to be perfect at every possible moment in order to make sure that people like you, that they accept of you, that they approve of you. So that's really, I think, why I wanted to describe perfectionism as really not something that not something that we think we've got to be perfect all the time, but actually something that hides an inner frailty underneath. And I think that's probably the most important way to look at perfectionism.
I actually wrote down another quote in Swedish. I haven't got it in my paper, but that I thought was really, 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 really good. And this is, of course, in Swedish. I'm going to try to do it in English. In Swedish, varje gång det går till överdrift här i livet är det ett tecken på någon okänd brist. And this is a quote from the psychotherapist Adam Phillips. Maybe yes. You remember the quote. Yeah. Do you have it in your mind?
Yes.
The right one in English?
Yes. The quote, I'm not exactly sure of the precise wording, but whenever we are excessive in our lives, it's a sign of some kind of sign of inner deprivation underneath. Yeah, and I think that's very true. Adam is a psychotherapist, so he deals with a lot of people who struggles wrapped in this need to excel. And what he sees time after time is a sense of whenever we go over the top of things, if we overconsume, if we overwork, if we overstrive or try to curate and perfect and in some way obsessively worry about how we appear, then that is an indication, or a strong indication, of a lack inside ourselves, in our interiors, that we're trying to plug, that we're trying to soothe. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I think perfectionism is really, in essence, that psychology crystallized as a characteristic. It is the escape from ourselves. It is the leap to try to be somebody perfect, you know, somebody who aces every test, who has all the right gadgets and toys, who lives the perfect lifestyle. You know, all of these excessive, extravagant, idealized ideas of who we should be. But of course, it's not real. It's not who we are. We're frail. We're fallible. Our lives are average, ordinary, most of us. And so, as a consequence, I think there is obviously deep inside of us a shame for that, and this is why we behave in these excessive ways. So I think it's a really nice quote, and it also, I think, provides good context for what it is that's behind perfectionism.
Definitely. So, do you have any idea of, like, why does a person become a perfectionist? Is it something, is it taught? Is it something we're born with? Or can you see any, like, anything that is, you can predict maybe the likability for someone becoming a perfectionist? What would you say?
Well, it's genetic to a great degree. So you're looking at about 30 to 40% of perfectionism is genetically inherited. But that also leaves a lot for the environment to explain too, and the rest of it is explained in wider culture, you know, in the things that we see on billboards, television screens, movie theaters, the glare of social media. You know, this is a very big part of modern society now, and that shapes a lot of the way we see ourselves through those lens, that comparative lens. You know, schools, colleges, the ways that they work and the pressures that are very strong within those institutions. You also have the workplace, of course, which has a lot of pressure to perform all the time in order to climb up the ladder. And we also have parents as well. We can't ignore the impact of parents too. You know, there's definitely a strong influence of parental practice on perfectionism, particularly high levels of expectation and contingent types of approval, which are also really important. So there's a lot of social factors out there, in short, that I think are weighing on pressures to be perfect. And so it's an intricate blend of genes, but also the environment.
Mm. I actually asked Medberoende Podden's followers on Instagram to grade, to use the MPS to sort of find out where they're as a group, where you can place them in the scale. And most of them were very high on this self-oriented part,
yes.
but not it was a bit mixed on the other two, where it's about other people involved. And my experience is that a lot of I would say that the codependent people that I meet, they are, you could place them in like two groups. One are those who are very like high achievers, maybe what you would like the typical perfectionist, that is really shown, you know, even everywhere you go, you can see it in the work, you can see it everywhere. Mm. But then there's another type of high achieving way of being that is more about, I have really high demands or expectations on myself, mm-hmm. and how to be in different situations and with other people. But with other people, I can be like, they can behave any way they like. And I don't feel like that's a bad thing. I always understand other people,
yes.
but I don't understand myself. What is your thought on this?
That is really interesting, because it's kind of what we see actually whenever we do exercises, more academic exercises, I suppose you'd say. Self-oriented is always the highest. And then we have the other two that come in a little bit behind. What's really interesting, actually, is the data that we're seeing shows that's still the case, but socially prescribed is catching up. Mm. And it's catching up really, really fast. By 2050, if the numbers are right and our models are correct, then the socially prescribed is actually going to overtake self-oriented. So if you were to do this same test in 30 years' time, you might see a different picture. Or you might not, depend on how society moves. But the point being, this is very common. This is what we see, and I think, to your point about the psychology and how we have these expectations for ourselves, perhaps not for other people. This goes back to what I was saying earlier about different people have different constellations. This is a very common constellation where you have very high self-set goals for yourself, really, really high, but only for yourself, right? And so you're self-critical on yourself. If you don't meet them, you can that you can harbor a lot of self-doubt. But interestingly, you can treat other people very differently to that. Maybe because you know how difficult it is for yourself to feel, so you don't want other people to go through that. And I think we may talk about this in a moment, but one of the key ways to overcome perfectionism is to really flip that psychology on its head and try as hard as you can to treat yourself in the same way that you would treat other people, because I think self-compassion and kindness is so important in overcoming some of the worst excesses of perfectionism.
Yeah, and I would say, like, my experience with those two groups that I was talking about, a lot of these people, I would say half of them are maybe grow up in families where the parents are like, they have really high standards and they expect the best or of the best of the best. So, and some of these people tend to get like maybe some kind of approval or something good when you do something extremely good. And for another part of these groups, I would say, is more of when you do really good is when you don't have to hear criticism. So you just get a little break from it. And then there's the group where you get like this approval, but they can always find something negative. So even though you score 99 out of 100 on a school test and you're the best in class, they will only focus on the 1% that's that you
right.
missed.
That's right.
And these are experiences that the group that I meet that are codependent.
Yeah.
They really have this kind of experience is very, very common.
Yeah.
If you think of the perfectionism part and you think of the social, you talked a bit about the parents there.
Yeah.
What is your experience with this?
Well, this is typical unrelenting standards. It's a sense that, you know, there is always more to do. And even what is an objectively high score is still not enough. And by the way, I see this too a lot in my students. I teach at the School of Economics, extremely selective school. Possibly a lot of the people that you interact with have went to the similar university because these are exceptionally high achievers. And it's tough. It's tough to watch because you can see that this is such a, you know, to even be here is an achievement. And then to get a first or a really high first grade is also an achievement. And then yet it isn't interpreted that way. It's an inability to see and reflect that actually, like, this is, you know, when you look and think of where you are, like, these people are 4 or 5 sigma individuals. You know, we're talking 1 in 100, 200, 300,000 in order to get to where they are. When you spell that out, you can see that they're hearing what you're saying, but it's not going. Mm-hmm. And that's the difficulty with this, and what I try to do is as much as I can with this kind of psychology, because it's very common among perfectionistic people, is to really, 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 really impress on them that reflection is so important. You have to situate where you are within a broader context of how far you've come, and it, like, you know, take that in, actually, like, savor that for a moment, just enjoy it. Because, you know, it's such an exhausting way to live if we're just never quite satisfied, even with objectively high standards. And look, it's a challenge and it's not easy, but that has to be the focus of any intervention, is self-reflection and just giving yourself a pat on the back every now and again.
Yeah. Do you have any numbers of how common perfectionism is? I mean, if you compare to society or like in the UK maybe, or do you have any numbers for it?
Yeah, we've got a lot of data now to show that perfectionism is rising. It's about socially prescribed perfectionism is the big one that's rising. So this is why I say, like, if we take the projections, self-oriented is rising a little bit, not that fast, but socially prescribed perfectionism is an exponential curve. So it's really kicking up. So this is why these models suggest that socially prescribed perfectionism is going to overtake social. And in terms of like hard numbers, socially prescribed perfectionism is about 40% up since the late 80s. That's a lot.
Mm.
Self-oriented a little bit less, you're looking at about 10%, same with other-oriented. So you have we have a lot of data now that's coming in, and by the way, we're continually collecting this data to show that these levels are rising. Now, I couldn't tell you how many people in a certain are perfectionist, because we don't classify perfectionism like that. It's more of a scale.
Yeah.
But what we can see is that the sliding scale is moving upwards. And that's the trend we should be focusing on.
Yeah, definitely. I was wondering, do you have any, if you look at it in a gender perspective, do you have any, like, is it more common in any of the genders or?
Interesting, no, which we didn't expect. We have got a very, very large data set of about 50,000 students, young people, of all sorts of backgrounds and genders. And we don't see relationships between levels of perfectionism and gender, which is really curious. It seems that males, females, they seem to be responding to perfectionism scales at roughly equivalent levels. Now, that doesn't mean to say, of course, that there aren't social expectations that meet that perfectionism and could create more problems with that perfectionism. I'll certainly have the argument, and I think there's certainly validity to the argument that there are expectations on girls and women, particularly on the way they should behave, the way they should look, the expectation to people please and all the rest of it. I think these are very live pressures that men perhaps get a bit of a free pass on, but the levels themselves seem to be roughly equivalent.
Interesting. I don't know if you know, but in Sweden we have a diagnosis called, it's not called burnout, it's called utmattningssyndrom. And it's also the cause for the highest rates in sick leave and the longest sick leave, and also the highest rates in relapse. I think it's almost 80% of these people who get the diagnosis utmattningssyndrom or some kind of stress diagnosis is women. Do you think about the burnout here? Of course, it's a diagnosis, so we have very, you have the criteria, so you can look at the symptoms as well. And these are they're called KEDS. It's a manual. You can just do a screening thing. And of course, burnout is a thing everywhere in the world.
Yeah,
it's just that we have it here as a diagnosis that you actually can get sick leave. Ended up with it. If you think of burnout and perfectionism, do you see the correlation there as well?
Huge correlation, yeah. And because perfectionistic people work hard, but they work unsustainably hard, and they push themselves well beyond comfort, and then some. And I think this is where the interaction with social factors really comes in, because those pressures on women in particular, it's really sad to hear the severity of those statistics, because they're not quite as large in other countries, but they are certainly skewed towards women. And it's, because of these reasons, the expectation and the difficulty and the challenge that women face, particularly, in high pressure, high octane workplaces where things move really quickly. And then you've got family considerations too, and having children, and when things are moving so quickly and you have to put separation in your career to put your family first, that can put women at a major disadvantage, to which they feel like they need to overcome, right? So you can begin to see how that those overcompensatory behaviors for those structural challenges can have a major impact on our mental health. And that's one of the reasons why we're so surprised not to see perfectionism higher, because we thought we would see it for those reasons. We didn't, but that doesn't mean to say that as I mentioned, the perfectionism that people hold doesn't interact with environments that can be tougher in certain ways for women.
But did you see how common perfectionism was? It was quite equal, but yes. Was that even when you looked at the consequences or the negative aspects on the mental health issues and stuff?
And that's a really good question. And this is called an interaction, where you see perfectionism interacting perhaps with gender to create more negative psychological outcomes. Across the work that's been done, there is certainly some evidence to suggest that that's the case, but this isn't an area that has a great deal of data, so I'd be hesitant to give you a concrete answer on that one. But absolutely, from the little information that we do have, when we've collected big data sets and looked at interaction between stress and gender and all the rest of it, we do tend to see particularly in appearance related social media domains, that's certainly the work that I've done anyway, that these relationships are stronger among girls and women than boys.
Interesting. So this is Medberoendepodden, which is codependency podcast. What is your experience or thought about codependency?
Well, Can I ask you?
Yeah.
I would love to know more about this concept, because this isn't something that is too big in the UK, where I come from. So I'd like to know what your perspective is on codependency.
We talked a little bit about this before we started here. But mostly, I think most people think of codependency that is something that is develops or, you know, happens when you are living close to someone with addiction. But the people that I work with, and I also have some really qualified good people, and we are working on maybe we're trying to move on with the scientific study in codependency. Yeah. But our experience is that we have people who have some kind of they have a really high first of all very high feeling of their responsibility towards other people's feelings, and also it's very performance-based self-worth, and you have also a lot of kind of high sensitivity going on, where they can just almost like the nervous system can know exactly how people are and feeling by just entering a room. And then you have this very high standards on yourself, and also this you mentioned like the kind of critical voice going on in your head. And I always say that people who suffer from codependency, they always have like a really loud judge going on, or inner critic that are telling them really bad stuff about themselves. Like they adapt in a way that is not healthy for themselves. So it gets really a lot of consequences, negative consequences for themselves with this kind of adaptment. And my experience is that a lot of these people, they develop this ability to adapt in early childhood, and also then tend to have the same kind of way to interact with other relationships through life. So it's more about a way of relating to myself and to the world that is it's driving all the codependence all the time. It's not just with someone's addiction. But of course, if you meet someone with an addiction, it's very easily for you to get super involved. You make it about you.
That's so fast. That's so interesting. And particularly that where it comes from, you know, this early life experiences can breed a sense of codependency. I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I suppose for me, I try to see perfectionism as more of a cultural phenomenon, and that if we see it all around us, even though it's completely irrational, we will feel that it's decidedly rational, because if everybody else is chasing for it, then it must be fine for me to do that too. And I think we can get wrapped up in that culture. We can certainly find ourselves very quickly immersed, and if we carry into it predisposed characteristics that lead to perfectionistic tendencies, or can then lead to perfectionist tendencies, and you can really begin to see that the culture, the society, and the perfectionism interact with each other to create all sorts of you may call them codependencies, a sort of dependency on living up to the standards of those around us and taking them on and expressing them ourselves. So I think it's really important, and certainly something that's very relevant for perfectionism.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that a lot of people who would say they are codependent also would say that they struggle somehow with perfectionism, even though it's not always like related to their specific job or something, but they sort of like they perfect themselves.
Exactly.
I would say, rather than just in school or work or other places like that.
It's about the self, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Interesting.
But we've talked about the problem quite a lot now.
Yeah.
What can you do? Can you become a recovering perfectionist, or how do you heal from it, or can you heal from it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's always hope. There has to be hope, and there is always hope, because, as I mentioned, this is a spectrum, and the challenge really is for us to just take ourselves backwards a little bit on that spectrum. And you can do that in many ways, but I think the most important way is to recognize that we are fallible, and that we are going to make mistakes, And so instead of trying to avoid them at all costs, be brave enough to put ourselves in positions where we do make them. So put your hand up to do a talk at work, for instance, if you don't feel like you're very confident in that domain. So it's so important to go through the discomfort that that's going to feel, but nevertheless, do it anyway. Because I think, you know, it's not just until you put yourself up to do a project, if you're not confident leading, or, you know, if there's a pitch or something, put your hand up to write if you don't feel like your writing is great. It's about pushing yourself outside of the comfort zone a little bit to get used to feeling those emotions a little bit, you know. And the more you do them, the more you realize actually there's nothing to be worried about. You know, everybody has to start somewhere, and we're not going to be world champion at everything we do the first time, and that's okay. And actually, you also notice something interesting too about other people's responses, because people are way more forgiving than you think they will be. And if you give a talk and it's not great, you know, it's very rare that you'll be castigated for that. It's more common that people will be supportive and they'll be helpful, and you'll be able to see in yourself the areas that you can do better next time. It's nowhere near, what I'm saying is nowhere near as catastrophic as what you build it up to be in your mind if you're a perfectionistic person. So get out of your comfort zone and just try things, push yourself out there, show up, and at the same time be kind to yourself, because when you do that, you're going to make mistakes, you're going to hit setbacks, you're putting yourself out there after all. So you need to be kind to yourself at every moment where there's difficulty. And that isn't, you know, that isn't just, oh, you know, pat yourself in the back. That's a real deep sense that it's okay, that I made a mistake. All humans make mistakes, nobody is perfect, and these are evidence that I was brave enough to put myself in the firing line a little bit, and that is what I need to recognize was brave about this act, not the fact that I screwed up or whatever. So self-compassion is really important. And then finally, just embracing the the joy of just being a human being, and what that and living inside a world that is an imperfect world. And if you've got children, or you're a teacher, an educator, or you're in charge of people in the work, lead by example. You know, show them that it's okay to fail, show them it's okay to be vulnerable, that these are very normal, humanizing experiences. And, you know, laugh about them, talk about them over coffee, over the dinner table. Basically, be a good example to other people that failure, imperfection, these are very humanizing, not humiliating experiences. And not only will you help yourself heal from your perfectionism, but you'll also be able to lead other people in a direction that moves them away from perfectionism too. So those are the things I'd recommend.
And I think a lot of the people that I meet that feel like they are codependent, a lot of them have really, we're talking about high standards, it's more about they're really drawn by doing right and they cannot do wrong. Yes. And especially if you put these codependent people in the parent situation, they're very, very driven of doing the right thing as a parent, and it drives them insane.
Mm.
And I think this is a very good message also for those people that just really, I mean, you have to sort of work with this with yourself. Otherwise, it's going to be something that our kids, they see this in us. And even though maybe we're not having like putting high standards on our kids, they will see if we put high standards on ourselves. Yeah. and like that it's not healthy anymore. Yeah. That's it.
Well, they're very impressionable creatures, children, and they learn a lot. I mean, a message to your parent listeners is really that there, you know, there is no such thing as a perfect parent. It doesn't exist. Kids have their challenges, and sometimes you're reduced to a helpless spectator, and that's also fine. It's okay. And also, it's important to recognize that it's not good for kids to have perfect parents either, because they need to have difficulty, they need to have setbacks, they need to be able to fall over and trip up and have, you know, grazes when they've made a mistake, or run into encounter setbacks which have become difficult for them, and they need to reconcile in their minds, because these are things they'll experience in their adult lives. So imperfection, the imperfect parent, is really what we should be striving for, because that's what life is. It's imperfect. So don't put too much pressure on yourself to make sure that you have to do everything 100% by the textbook. Sometimes you won't, and that's okay.
Thank you for that. Do you have any like things that maybe like tools or something that you yourself use daily life or in specific occasions, or that help you to deal with the not pushing yourself to be perfect in all situations?
I have a few things. I mean, procrastination is a big problem with perfectionistic people because they're so fearful of failure. They manage that anxiety by distancing themselves and removing themselves from situations. Very common. So one of the things I try to do there is set myself a very small, short burst of time to get things started. Because we know, the evidence says, if you get things started, you're more likely to finish them. It sounds obvious, but for the perfectionist, it's not so intuitive as that, because it's really, the starting part is really tough. So give yourself short chunks of time, 10, 15 minutes, turn everything off, all distractions off, turn the internet off, and just start what you need to do. Just get words on a page. It doesn't matter if they're any good, you can always edit. Right, you can edit a bad piece of work, you can't edit a non-existent piece of work. And so for me, that's the important part, because once perfectionists get started, they feel like they're making progress. It's much easier for them to get to the finishing line. So I sometimes set myself those little goals. I would also say, I mean, this, the black and white thinking that you're talking about, like, yeah, I must do this, I have to do that. This is very common in perfectionism people too. There's no middle ground. It's basically all or nothing. That is also a distorted way to think. It's an irrational way to think. And as soon as those things are coming into your mind and they're really taking over your psychology, that's the moment to intervene. But don't repress it. Write it down. It's a really useful exercise to diary these thoughts, because then you can really integrate, interrogate them. Like, do I, you know, I must complete this presentation by this date to this level of quality. I know this is, you know, it has to be perfect. Right? Sometimes, so write this down. Like, okay, how much should you believe this? And what you know, on a 0 to 10 or whatever, just rate it. And then ask yourself, okay, if I don't totally believe this, then why is it that I don't totally believe this? Because it doesn't have to be perfect, or it doesn't have to be, you know, in the perfect edited finished shape by the deadline. It can, we can leave something behind if, because it's going to be iterated or it's going to be vetted, right? So you can begin to soften those beliefs one by one as you start to introspect on them, and you can start to reframe them into far kinder, more constructive ways of thinking that, okay, it would be nice to have it in this shape, but if not, it's still fine. You can remind yourself that good enough is good enough. Like, if it isn't quite at the ultimate bulletproof level that I'm happy with, well, it's still going to go anyway. You know, that I'm not going to let those black and white thinking block me from moving forward. So I think diarying and writing down and reframing those kind of beliefs is also very, very important. And I try to do that as much as I can. I have other tips in the book, but those are the two that have really helped me the most.
Yeah, and you write also in the end of the book that you're, I mean, it actually became a book, is like something to celebrate, especially when you're a perfectionist. Yeah. I mean, just achieving, just doing something, accomplishing something, and not being stopped by, is it perfect? that's something to celebrate, isn't it?
Definitely, it's so important to just put stuff out there. You know, there's nothing wrong with working hard. There's nothing wrong with wanting to make something as best as it can possibly be. But at some point, you have to release it.
Yeah.
You have to. And it's that moment of release that you think is going to be the most difficult part. But actually, the most difficult part is worrying about releasing it. When you've actually released it, it's amazing how... It's like taking a sledgehammer to perfectionism. It's in the world now. I've got no control over it. So it's pointless me worrying about one-star reviews or, you know, the Wall Street Journal not enjoying a certain aspect of the book. Like, no point in worrying about it. I've got no control over that. Some reviewer is going to have their say, and I don't, you know, what can I do? I can't change it. And, you know, you're going to get a lot of amazing feedback because you've put a lot of work into it, but you'll also get not so good feedback. That's just life, you know. And we live in an imperfect world. Not everybody's going to agree with you, and there is something extremely liberating for the perfectionist of just letting things go, and what will be. And so, and that applies not just to books, that applies to presentations, pitches. You know, if you work as a carpenter, you know, chairs, tables, whatever you make, whatever you bring into the world. The focus should not be on what other people think, but that's the perfectionist focus. The focus should be on what you're leaving in the world, and whether people you inspire change, educate, or just give people something to use, something functional. It doesn't matter what it is, but that should be the most important motivation.
Definitely. And I think being a perfectionist, my experience is that especially if I compare it to these codependent people that I meet, a lot of them put their perfectionism into healing perfectionism, if you understand what I mean. So you get like really, you have to do the best. You have to reach out to the best person that can help you. You have to work, you know. So you get really driven by the same perfection in healing it.
Yeah, so what can
you say to these people?
It's so true. You know, it's the classic perfectionist response to, well, you should try some mindfulness. I don't have time for mindfulness.
No, exactly.
Look, it's what you have to do. The world we live in will always force us into feeling like we have to or should be doing things. Mm. Even if they're healthy, the very fact that we feel like we should do it changes it completely. And if you, mindfulness, yoga, whatever, Pilates, these are healthy things, things that can be incredibly useful to our mental health. But if we are doing them because we've seen on TikTok or Instagram that someone told us we should do this because this is really good for our health, then that changes the whole meaning of the activity itself. It has to be integrated. It has to be something that brings you joy. And it has to be something that gives you some sense of purpose. And if that's yoga, meditation, whatever, that's great, but it has to come from that place. If it's playing music, if it's baking, it doesn't matter. It has to come from a place of love and enjoyment, because that's where joy comes from. So, you know, it's very, very, that's such an important point, that when it comes to thinking about how we can turn the corner on our perfectionism, it's very important we don't use that perfectionism to find remedies, and actually we're taking a different path completely, which rejects perfectionism, which says there is no perfect way to treat my perfectionism or to overcome my perfectionism. And actually the most important thing is to find something that aligns with my own values and throw myself into it, because that's how we break free.
Thank you for that. And when I speak about my own issues with codependency, I always sort of describe it as everything I've done, I've had like a really, you know, a whip making me do stuff. Mm. And in recovery and trying to heal these things, I try to change, you know, put that away and let the motivation be like self-care or something more, you know, warm. You can go to the gym, or you can do something, if you can do it with different motivations. And I think what you just told me just added on to that kind of feeling around
it. It's a really important point, because I think we don't recognize that enough, that the reason we're doing the healing is just as, if not more important than the actual healing itself.
Mm. Would you like to add anything else to the listeners that we've been talking about? Perfectionism, we've been talking about also the healing part. Do you want to add anything else? Have we missed something?
No, I think we've covered so many bases, and I think the conversation has really touched on many important points around this issue. So I'm really content that we've done a lot of covered a lot of ground here, and I hope your listeners enjoy the episode.
I'm very sure they will, and I really recommend everyone to read your book. It's Perfektionsfällan in Swedish, and I'm so grateful that you took time, and I'm honored that you want to guest Medberoendepodden, Thomas.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a great chat.
Thomas Currens bok Perfektionsfällan finns ute på marknaden nu, och jag rekommenderar den varmt. Vill du veta mer om medberoende och var du kan vända dig, då är du välkommen in på vår hemsida www.medberoendepodden.se. Jag erbjuder kurser och individuella samtal för dig som vill behandla ditt medberoende. Vill du veta mer om det, går du också in på vår hemsida eller kontakta mig via mail på ida.hogstrom@medberoendepodden.se. För att kunna fortsätta driva Medberoendepodden är jag tacksam för ditt stöd. Du kan som privatperson stötta Medberoendepodden genom ett valfritt Swish-bidrag eller via Patreon. Vill du, ditt företag eller organisation sponsra Medberoendepodden är du välkommen att kontakta mig via mail. Och glöm för guds skull inte att följa Medberoendepodden i sociala medier. Idag är Medberoendepodden en plattform för läkning och tillfrisknande med massor av inspirerande inlägg. Så in och följ oss där. Thank you.